Okay, we're moving on to the next book in the Narnia series. Right, Wine, Witch, and Wardrobe. And just as the magician's nephew gave us the story that had the doctrines of the creation and the fall, what sort of doctrine does the line Witch and Wardrobe give us? The story of... You don't remember.
Oh, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
I know that, but what story, what biblical narrative does the... Yes, redemption, right, redemption. Redemption and salvation. So, magician's nephew gave us a picture of the creation and fall. Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe gives us the story of redemption and salvation. And so, how many of y'all have read this before? Everybody's read this? Okay, well, good. So I'm not, like, spoiling it for you when I talk about it. Because I have to talk about it a little bit in order to explain some things. Okay. So in this book, Edmund betrays his brother, his two sisters, right? And through his betrayal, he becomes the White Witch's property. She makes claims to him. And she demands what's rightfully hers. And in response to this, Aslan makes an arrangement with the witch. And what does he do in this arrangement? Let's raise your hand. Raise your hand. Now you don't want to raise your hand? Go ahead. He sacrifices himself. That's right. He gives himself up to the witch in exchange for Edmund's life. Right. So Aslan meets her at the stone table. And it's there that he's tied up. And he's insulted, and he's ridiculed, and he's blasphemed, and he is ultimately killed. And in killing Aslan, the witch was appealing to what was called deep magic, right? Y'all remember that? Which, what is deep magic in Narnia? It's basically the demands of justice and the law, right? But the witch didn't know that there was a deeper magic. And what is that deeper magic? We could put this in biblical terms. What's the deeper magic? What didn't she know about?
Redemption?
Yeah, could you be more specific?
Sacrificing?
Well, yeah, we kind of already said that. Yeah, but we talked about how the deep magic is the law and the standard. That, you know, the wages of sin is death. But what it was the deeper magic that she didn't know about. She thought she had him.
I don't know. I learned when God died on the cross.
Do what? Right. What happened when Jesus died on the cross? Satan thought he had Jesus. But he was very surprised when he rose up from the grave. Why? What was that deeper magic, if we could call it that?
God's grace.
God's grace, exactly. God's grace. Yep. So, Aslan comes back to life, he's resurrected, and he defeats the witch. Right? And through this story, children can see the nature and the power of substitutionary atonement. Right? And even though Aslan dies in exchange for Edmund, C.S. Lewis really wants us to see a little bit more broadly than that. Did Aslan just die for Edmund? It seems that way, huh? But as you read on in the last battle, when we finally get to that book, the last king of Narnia said this. He said that it was through the blood of Aslan that all Narnia was saved. So, did Jesus, if you're a Christian, did Jesus die for you?
Yeah.
Certainly. But he also died for what? The world. He died for the entire world. What's John 3:16? Can anyone quote that by memory? One time. Does somebody raise your hand? Landon.
For God so loved the world, he gave his one and only son, so that whoever may believe in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. Thank you.
Very good. Yes, so for God so loved the world. So it's the same thing in Narnia. That's what Lewis wanted to help children understand. That even though Aslan certainly died for Edmund individually, the Lord certainly dies for us individually, right? As individual persons, there's also a corporate element to it. He's also dying for the salvation of the world. And that's what Lewis wanted to communicate. And so After Aslan comes back to life, he goes to the witch's castle, where she has many Narnians imprisoned. And these guys are all turned to stone. Now, does this sound familiar? There's so many biblical parallels here. And in the image of the gift of the Holy Spirit, what does Aslan do to bring them back to life? He breathes on them. All right? So what kind of biblical picture does that point to with us? After Christ went to the cross, he was resurrected from the dead. He sits at the right hand of the Father. He sends his Spirit to do what? He sets the captives free. What does he do? What does the Spirit do in our lives?
Saves
us. But using that imagery, these people were dead and turned to stone. You're on track. I thought you were going to say it. Our hearts were also stoned at one point. We were dead in our trespasses and sins. And it was the breath of the Holy Spirit that turned our stony hearts into hearts of flesh, made us alive again. So that's what Lewis is attempting to communicate in a way that a child can understand it. Right? How many of y'all have a much better understanding of the gospel because of you reading Narnia? Have you ever thought about it this way before?
Not really.
Well, no? Yeah, so when you think of Aslan, you really don't think of him as Christ. You do. So it has in some way. It helps. Lewis has helped you in some way to understand the character of God and of Christ a lot more. There's a lot more parallels to the Bible in this story that I hope you'll have the eyes to see as you read it. And it'll help us understand God and the gospel and the world a lot more. Okay, so let's talk about the main characters. Who are some main characters? Well, we have four children. Anybody remember their names? Caroline? Uh-huh.
Susan.
Right, so we have Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. Bonus points for the last name.
Oh,
Pevensey. Pevensey, right. Very good. Very good. So they're brothers and sisters. And so when Lucy made her first trip into Narnia, who does she meet? Mr. Tumnus, the fawn, right? And later, when all the children are there in Narnia, they all meet Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. And then we have Jadis, who we met in the last book. She's the evil queen of charm, and she's back, and she has become the White Witch. And she rules Narnia at the beginning of the book, and she holds Narnia under her spell. And what has she done to Narnia? Or maybe you had a question about something else.
Yeah. What happened to the tree? Why? I thought she couldn't go into Narnia.
Well, we're getting into that whenever we actually get into the book. Just hold that question for another time, all right?
That she makes it winter without Christmas?
Right, exactly. She makes Narnia endure an eternal winter. Now, in Louisiana, we can't really identify with this too well. Maybe Landon can, since he's from the north, the great white north. He understands snow. Well, that's true. You lived through some snow as a little boy, huh? You did too. That's true. Well, I have more people that understand this than I thought. So... how many of you whoever lived in the north, are excited when the first snow comes? No one's excited when the first snow comes?
I was excited.
Yeah, sure.
The best thing to wake up to.
Yeah. The first time. It gets old, I know.
Oh, for sure.
But
not in the old part, it's cold.
Uh-huh.
But,
all right. Never mind. Throwing a wet blanket on my party right now. Snow, as in and of itself, the first snow is very exciting. Because what does it remind you of? Especially when it occurs in November. It reminds you that Thanksgiving's coming up. Christmas is coming up. The holidays are here. Right? So compare that to maybe it's been snowing for a while. And it's January. What is there really to look forward to when it comes to cold weather in January? Spring.
No school.
Spring. Springtime. But here's the thing. It's like Jadis made this this curse on Narnia where it's winter, but there's no Christmas coming up. There's no hope of any sort of redemptive quality about this. And it's like it's winter in January without any hope of spring. Eventually, you're going to get tired of the snow. Trust me, Louisianians, you will get tired of the snow. You'll get tired of cold weather. You eventually want the snow to melt, and you want to experience spring. But in Narnia, that never happens. Jadis has made it Narnia a very depressing place, and it's just cold, dark, and snowy all the time. Okay, and this leads up to another character who's Father Christmas, which is very interesting that Narnia has anything to do with Christmas time, because there's really no Christ named that way in Narnia, but I guess he's... Lewis does have a point with this, too. Okay.
He hasn't been really born yet. Like, he wasn't really born either.
Who's that?
Like, it's like Christmas is celebrating Jesus' birth, but, I mean, it doesn't really happen.
Well, Aslan was kind of incarnated at the beginning of the world. There are some differences between Narnia and Earth, you know. So I'm just mentioning these characters to get us familiar with them. So we have Father Christmas, we have Jadis, of course we have Aslan, who's the central character in this book, just like in all the other ones. So let's talk about the worldview behind Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. So imagine for a moment that you were teleported back at in time, and you were sitting or standing at the foot of the cross. And Jesus is on the cross, and he's dying. What would you do? Think about the scene. Imagine it. We try to get him off. Well, you'd probably get speared by a Roman. So picture it first. So you're surrounded by the crowd, and many people in that crowd are reviling Christ and mocking him and insulting him. And off to your right, you see the soldiers getting out their dice, and they're looking at Jesus' cloak on the ground, and they're about to start gambling for it and all that. And women would be crying and weeping, and everything would be in disarray.
Actually,
okay?
I would probably try to teleport back to the future.
No control of teleportation. You're there. All right, listen up. So, and you are the only one. You're the only one, because you've been to the future. You know how this story is going to end up. You know Jesus is going to rise again. You know he's going to rise up victorious, and he's going to eventually put all his enemies under his feet. But no one else really knows this. So, eventually the sky would turn dark, and after God and his wrath was finished with Jesus, Jesus would cry out, "It is finished." You're hearing all of this. Okay? And actually, the Greek word is better, to be paid in full. That's what Christ is saying, that the debt has been paid. Okay? And so I'm sure that many people on that day, when they heard that, were very confused about Jesus. What are you saying? What are you talking about? Maybe he's delirious up there. Maybe he's lost too much blood. But you know why he's saying all of that, right? So even though you know what's going to happen next, would your reaction to Jesus on the cross be any different from theirs?
Yes.
Yeah, I would probably stay motionless, because I might crush a bug and cause an alien invasion.
Would y'all turn around to the crowd? Yeah. This is great news.
No,
this is great. He's going to pay for the redemption of us all. This is wonderful. As you see this dying, bleeding man on the cross. I don't think your reaction would be that much different.
I'd be afraid to intervene.
I would try to comfort everyone else.
It's okay. This is supposed to happen.
Right.
Okay, all right. Listen up. So, as we begin the line, Witch and Wardrobe, I know all of y'all have read this before. I know all of y'all are familiar with this book already. So, we need to just remember. I know you know how it turns out, but there'll be some pretty rough moments in it, right? When Aslan is bound and tied to the stone table. Yeah, shouldn't be like, yes. This is great news. It is great news. But if you were there, you wouldn't necessarily, you wouldn't be that socially inept not to be mournful and sad with the other people, right? This is great. I'm so happy as this man's getting pulled out and he gets bound to this table.
Like he's stabbing him. We're like stabbing.
How many of y'all watched the movie? How many of y'all watched the movie and during that scene?
Oh,
and y'all are just ecstatic. So
happy. No.
Oh, I loved it. I was like,
right. So you wouldn't be very happy about it, even though you know how it's going to turn out. Okay.
Well,
So, getting back to the book, with this is the second book in the chronological series here. So we need to spend a little bit more time working out the chronology of the events that's taking place here. Are you okay?
What just happened?
I laughed.
Anyhow, what was I saying before I was distracted? So let's work out the chronology of this book. Why don't you two face the front? Face the front. You need to have a posture of attention. There you go. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so we need to work out the chronology of things here. So we're going to work out the chronology of the years in Narnia with the years in England, because they're kind of going back and forth between these two things. So, Diggory and Polly, remember them from the last book? They get into Narnia in the year 1900 on Earth time, right? And since they were there at the creation of Narnia, what year would it be there?
Zero.
Technically zero, but we could say year one, the first year. Okay? So we read all about that in the last book. So the next visit to Narnia, done by Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy in the second book, is in 1940, England time. Okay? But 1,000 years of Narnian time has gone by.
I thought it was 100.
It's 1,000. So, and while these four siblings are ruling Narnia, the adventures of Shasta and Erebus, those things are happening too. And we'll read about them later in The Horse and His Boy. But then, in the Narnian year 1015, the four children go back to England. But when they get back to England, they soon discover that virtually no time has gone by since they got back. Okay?
3 years for every minute.
Huh?
3 years for every minute.
No, it doesn't seem to be very consistent at all. No time has gone by. They ruled Narnia for 15 years, and then they get back to England, and no time has gone by at all. Okay? That would be very strange. That's what's going on. So they get into Narnia again in 1941, a year later, in Prince Caspian, only to discover that it is the Narnian year 2303. So we've jumped 1,300 years.
Wow, wow.
So the kids get back to England, they spend a year in England, and then in Prince Caspian, they go back, and how much time has passed? 1,300 years.
A lot of time.
So, and then when they return to England after this adventure, Peter and Susan are told that they're not going to be going back to Narnia. Their time in Narnia is done.
Heartbreaking.
That is kind of sad. But Edmund and Lucy do come back, and this time they're bringing Eustace with them. Remember Eustace? Yeah. Yeah. Well, at the beginning he was. So this is in the summer of 1942 in England, in the year 2306 to 2307 in Narnia. Okay, and then a few months later, in the fall of 1942, Eustace comes back to Narnia with Jill Pole, and they rescue Prince Rillian in the Narnian year 2356. So 50 more years went by in Narnia while they were back for just a little while. And that story's in the Silver Chair.
It's really confusing for the Narnians, these people
just come
back and forth.
Well, they're dead. Those people died. All those creatures. Probably. I know. So, and in 1949, England time, Jill and Eustace are called back to Narnia again for the last battle. At this point, it is 2555 in Narnian time. So that's 200 years later. And that world essentially ends. Narnia ends. It's the end of that world. And so, and because of the differences in time, it's really cool. Diggory could see that world created when he was 12 years old, and then he can see it, the end of that world, over 2,500 years later when he was 61 years old. Imagine that. You could see the beginning of a world, and then 2,500 years later, you can see the end of the world, and only 61 years of your life has gone by. pretty cool. So the events in the Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, they happen right in the middle of the history of Narnia. Okay? And so the tree of protection, which is what you were talking about earlier, that Diggory planted, has somehow been bypassed. Lewis doesn't really give us much of a clue as to how this happened or why this happened. And by this point, that tree has been bypassed. And the White Witch has been ruling in Narnia for 100 years at this point. And she has made it to where it's always winter and it's never Christmas. And it's a really interesting thing because the mention of Christmas as this Narnian holiday is kind of an interruption of that great supposal, right? Remember I talked about the great supposal? What do I mean by that? What did Lewis mean by that? Not ringing any bells?
No bells ringing up here.
What's a supposal?
Proposal.
Not a proposal, a supposal.
Like,
suppose this should happen. So what is Lewis trying to communicate? Suppose...
Something
good.
Suppose that
Christ.
The tree...
No.
Suppose that the witch is growing more powerful.
Suppose that there would be another world from Earth in which God, the doctrines of the Lord Jesus Christ and God could be carried out somewhere else. What would that look like? That's how we came, that's why we have Aslan, that's how we have this other world. How would the gospel look maybe in another world? So just suppose for a moment that God and the Lord Jesus Christ manifested himself in that world in a different way. And we can see other, like kind of turning the gospel in different ways, see different facets of the gospel. Okay? Y'all remember that now? Oh, yeah. Yeah. You supposedly? Yes. So, but it's interesting that this whole idea of Christmas is kind of an interruption to that. Right? Because Lewis makes it clear that Christ is known by his name only in our world, but he's known as Aslan in the other world. So, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe Lewis is still trying to work out some of the details in the first book of the series. Remember, The Lion and the Witch of the Wardrobe, even though this is second chronologically, this is the first book of the series that he wrote. He doesn't write The Magician's Nephew is the sixth book in the published series. Okay? So, all right. There's a few other details that we could, we'd be surprised to find out in one of the later books after Lewis has hit his stride. For example, the image of Mrs. Beaver using a sewing machine is very odd in this medieval world, right? But remember, this world kind of looks like knights and they have armor on, they ride horses. You know, we don't really think that a sewing machine would be very, it would have a prominent place here. Would it really mix in? Like a modern sewing machine. A lot of people were just sewing either by using needle and thread, or they were using some primitive version of a sewing machine. But Mrs. Beaver was like using a very sophisticated piece of equipment for that time. So that seems a bit strange. So
it's a bit strange is that beavers are talking.
Well, sure, that is strange. I understand that.
No, they're just beavers.
Well, even so, but think of one of the drawings. If those books you have are illustrated, right? They have pictures in them, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Think about this. One of the drawings in there, they have Aslan walking, not only talking and doing human things, but he's literally walking on his hind legs like a human beside the witch. Two paws behind his back like this. Y'all don't remember seeing that image? Yeah, him and the White Witch are negotiating for Edmund, and he's walking on his hind legs with her with his paws behind his back. So that looks kind of weird. So this kind of reflects his human and animal skins understanding, right? And it's interesting because when C.S. Lewis was a boy, he wrote a story about talking animals called Boxen. And in that story, the animals were basically people who looked like animals. They didn't act very much like animals at all. You know, in a lot of books, a lot of children's books, like animals will, they'll be talking and they sound like humans and they reason like humans, but they'll still act like animals. in many ways. Like, they'll still crawl on all fours. They'll still climb trees if they're monkeys or...
Or
Winnie the Pooh. Well, Winnie the Pooh is not like that at all. He's on his hind legs all the time.
Well, yeah, but so do bears. Bears kind of do.
They do that sometimes. So anyway, so it seems like some of those details, the things he wrote as a kid, kind of are still coming into his books as an adult. Okay? But I think by the time Narnia matures in his mind, as he keeps on thinking about Narnia and how he's going to write it on paper, it seems like those really human qualities disappear. Okay, so I mentioned earlier, too, that Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe is the central theme is essentially redemption and salvation. And so that tells us that Lewis really understands the nature of sin, as well as the weaknesses of man. But at the same time, Lewis doesn't use those. He doesn't use those weaknesses in order to explain away personal responsibility for sin. So as the book starts, Peter is 13, I believe, and Susan is 12, and Edmund is 10, and Lucy is 8. So they're all children. And Edmund has been in a bad situation at school, and he has started to bully kids that are younger than he is. Okay? And among the four siblings, Edmund is the second to youngest, okay? And Lucy is really the only one that he could bully and lord that over, that he's older than them. So he does that. And so not only do the Pevensey children have their petty arguments and stuff, but this shows that there are some fundamental issues in their relationships that's going to cause bigger problems for them as they become adults. And we'll see that later on in the books, okay? Because eventually these kids grow up and... as they come into their kingship and their rulership, they become adults. Remember, they spend 15 years in Narnia in that first round. So by the time they go back home, they're all like essentially either late teens and early 20s as they're ruling. And you're going to see some of these relationship issues come out in other ways as they get older. Right. Well, there's other reasons they weren't married. They kind of talk about that later on in the books. Mm-hmm. So, later on in the voyage of the Dawn Treader, Lucy is tempted to say a spell that will make her beautiful beyond all mortal reckoning. And she's tempted to do this, to say this spell and become beautiful. Why is that? Why is this such a temptation for her? Anybody remember, Amelia? Why? Susan, yeah, well, Lucy wasn't really known as being the pretty one of the two. Susan was known to be the pretty one. And so you could see that there's a little bit of jealousy there, and she was jealous of some of the attention that Susan gets because she's pretty, right? And so but the relationship between Edmund and Peter is very similar. It's not about beauty or anything. What is that about? His authority, that's right. Yeah, Edmund is kind of jealous that Peter always gets to make the decisions and he's the one that's in charge. Right. And so he's aggravated that he has to sit under the authority of Peter, and that aggravation ends in Edmund betraying Peter. And Peter does something in his whole situation that makes things even worse. So when they are explaining Edmund's betrayal of them to Aslan, Peter takes responsibility for the part of his earlier anger played into pushing Edmund toward the witch. He takes total responsibility of that. Even though Peter's anger was a response to treachery on Edmund's part, Peter takes responsibility, at least partial responsibility for it. I didn't have to, even though I was justified to be angry right back and to say what I said, in some sense, I probably shouldn't have, because maybe it wouldn't have pushed Edmund so far to go and side with the witch.
Is that a bad thing?
Sure, it's what is a bad thing?
Go and side with the witch? Peter to wait. Is it a bad thing Peter's taking responsibility for that, or is it a good thing?
No, it's a good thing.
Oh.
Aslan doesn't argue with him. Oh. He's like, he doesn't say, oh, no, it's okay, buddy. You were totally justified in what you did. No, Aslan just pretty much nods his head. Yeah, that's true. You didn't help. And so that's one chief reason why maybe Aslan chose Peter to be the High King is because of that humility. So at the beginning of Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, Lucy makes it into Narnia on her own, right? But because her absence in England didn't take any time away, and because the back of the wardrobe was a solid piece of wood, when they all go check, she comes back and says, "I've been to this wonderful place. It's full of snow and all of this stuff." And they're like, "You are silly. We don't believe anything you're saying. You're just, you know, this is your imagination."
I mean, if my sister said that, I wouldn't believe her.
Yeah.
Sure. That's understandable. Yes.
Why does the wardrobe turn back into wardrobe?
Well, maybe it's to test the faith and the belief of the older siblings.
Interesting.
Yeah. Maybe. So Peter and Susan, Lucy's been going on about this place called Narnia and Mr. Tumnus and all of these guys. And so Peter and Susan are kind of worried about her. She's lost her marbles. She seems crazy, right? And so who do they go talk to try to get this figured out?
The professor.
Who is the professor? What's his name?
Diggory.
It's Diggory, yes, Diggory. Diggory's a little older now. Yeah, and they're expecting him to say, "Yes, you're right. She does seem like she's off a rocker." But what does he do? He surprises them with a certain response. And to me, this response is fundamental to Lewis's defense of the Christian faith. This is his apologetic approach that Diggory uses. And it's the same argument he uses in his book, Mere Christianity. So there are only three possible responses to Lucy's story about Narnia. Okay, what's one response?
I believe
you. So what she could be saying is true. What's the other one?
I don't believe you.
Well, there is that. There's two reasons to not believe her, and there's one reason to believe her. What's one of the reasons not to believe her?
She's either lying.
She's lying, that's one.
Or she truly believes it, and she's just crazy.
So she's crazy, she's lying, or she's telling the truth.
Or she's
that would be a contradiction in terms. Yes. So either she's lying, she's crazy, or she's telling the truth.
But she could be crazy and lying at the same time.
Could be. So the professor says that she is clearly not out of her mind. Why? Why does he say that?
She seems sane.
Yes, that's right. And Peter and Susan, they say, man, she is far less likely to be telling lies, especially compared to Edmund. Edmund's been telling lies lately, a lot of them. And so Lucy seems to be, she's much more honest. She has a reputation of being honest. So that leaves only one option. She's telling the truth. Okay. Now this argument also applies to Jesus, right? So Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, which is the kind of thing that honest men in their right minds don't do, right? I don't run around saying I'm the Son of God. If I did, you would think I'm crazy. You know, it's the same thing that you, you saying that you're the queen of the fairies or something, or to use Lewis's example, that I am a poached egg. It's his example, not mine. So you're a poached egg. So that means that if Jesus isn't the Son of God, then he's either a liar or a lunatic. Okay? But
what
then.
What is a poached egg?
I'm claiming I am this desk. That's kind of the same idea. He's just using a random object as an example. Okay? So if Jesus isn't the Son of God, then he's either a liar or he's crazy. But the nature of his teaching, the things he taught about, in the example that he set for people that we can read about, crosses out both of those options. So he was telling the truth. Right? Can y'all see that? Yeah. So there's no way that we can say, you know how some people say, maybe you don't, but some people say that Jesus was a very good moral teacher, but he wasn't the Son of God. Right? How can we even say that? How can we even say that he was a morally good teacher if he kept on either lying about being the Son of God? Because he said all those things in the same conversation sometimes. Doesn't sound very moral to me if he's lying all the time about who he is. Right? Or he's crazy. So how can we even take what he says at face value if there's a crazy person saying it, right? So that's kind of the options here. So the other option is that he truly is the Son of God. And we can see through logic and deduction that he was, right? So how many of y'all know what the word epistemology means?
Faith.
Well, kind of. Why are y'all saying faith? Pistuo in Greek? Yeah, that's part of it. Yes. Huh? Well, epistemology is the branch of philosophy that basically concerns how we know what we know. How do we know that the things we know are true or not? Well, we can't just know. There has to be an epistemology. All of us have an epistemology. How do we know that the sun is going to come up tomorrow? Don't tell me the answer. I don't need to know the answer. But you have an answer. You have an epistemology. Okay?
I do.
Huh? Yeah, sure you do. Absolutely.
Well, I just thought maybe
you know for sure that your dad is not going to give you up for adoption tomorrow, right?
I think so.
Yeah, you think so because you have you have presuppositions as to the nature and character of your parents that can lead you to a pretty fair conclusion that they're not going to abandon you, right? Absolutely. So that's what that is, epistemology. How do we know what we know? And so for most non-Christian philosophers, this is up for debate, how we know what we know, because there's no overarching standard or foundation to base it on. But Lewis addresses this question in a faithful Christian way. And there are two aspects to this question. One is loyalty. The other is story. So Edmund has already become somewhat of a bully in England. So he teases Lucy over her saying that she's been to Narnia. And then when he finds himself in Narnia, he realizes that, oh, I was wrong about this. Right. And he can't find Lucy because she's out in the snow somewhere. They're in the woods. And he shouts out an apology to her, right, and to the woods around him. And when she doesn't answer, because she's not there, Edmund blames her for not accepting his apology.
How dare you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
How dare you?
Fine.
Right?
So this clearly shows us that Edmund's heart issues have not been dealt with at all in that confession, in that apology. And in this condition, this hard-hearted condition, he meets the witch. And she gives him this enchanted Turkish delight and makes him promise to bring his brothers and two sisters with him next time. And it's not very good. I've had Turkish delight.
Very
careful.
Anyway,
so I don't want to lose train of thought here. So why does the witch want him to bring his siblings so badly?
Because she wants to kill them, so she
Why?
Can reign forever.
Well, what do they have to do with her reigning forever?
Well,
they're just little kids.
Prophecy about them being kings.
Say that again.
About them being kings.
Right, exactly. There is a prophecy going around, and there are four empty thrones at Cair Paravel, and there's a prophecy that says that four sons and daughters of Adam and Eve are going to sit on them and fill those thrones, okay? And so when Edmund and Lucy make their way back in England, Edmund lets Lucy down by denying having been there with her. And Peter's angry at Edmund for stringing her along like this and making her cry. And so this problem between Edmund and Peter keeps growing. It keeps growing. And when the four of them get back into Narnia, Edmund reveals, not on purpose, that he's been there before. And what does Peter do? He's ticked. He is furious at him. And so nothing is clearer than the fact that Edmund has this basic fundamental problem. His heart is not in the right place at all. And with this basic problem driving him, Edmund is the one who raises all of these epistemological questions. Right? He says, how do we know if the robin is a really good kind of bird? Remember when the robin was leading them in the woods? How do we know that this robin is a good kind of bird? It's a bird that can be trusted. How do we know that the witch is wicked and the fawns are good? They may be saying the witch may seem like she's wicked, the fawns may seem like they're good, but how do we really know?
Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe the witch has been slandered. Maybe everybody's just been talking bad about her, and she's actually a really nice person. See, the problem is that he can't see what should be obvious from the stories he has heard. How do we know that the witch is wicked? We've read enough stories about wicked witches to know that she fits the profile of someone who is wicked. We have read enough stories and heard enough stories to know, right? And that's his problem. He hasn't either read these stories or he hasn't learned anything from these stories. Or he doesn't want to see what the results are from these stories because his heart is so hardened. And I think that's a problem with a lot of Christians today. Many Christians today don't know how they're supposed to think about someone or something because they haven't read the right stories or they haven't read enough of them. They haven't read the Bible enough and the stories in there to know how to judge someone that's maybe an authority or some threatening figure. I don't know. So they can't see the story that they're currently in, and so they don't know what to do. We're all in this story. The biblical story, you know, that we have our Bibles, we're still in this story. This story is still going on. Obviously, the pages aren't being filled with more words, but we are somewhere in the middle of this narrative. And if we don't know the end of the book and how things are going to go, how do we know what to do or what's going to happen? Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Edmund doesn't know this. Or he's willingly, shielding his eyes from it. I don't know. Think about this. The serpent in the garden raised all the same questions that Edmund did. The devil and those in his kingdom always go to the same questions of epistemology. How do we know if we will die if we eat from this tree? How do we know that the witch is evil and bad? Well, the Bible teaches us that the process of intellectual unbelief comes from problems of the heart. Remember, Edmund's heart has already been hardened at this point. He hasn't resolved any of those issues between him and his brothers and sisters. So his heart is already hardened. So that leads him to disbelieve even in his mind. So in Romans 1, the Apostle Paul reasons this way. Because men wouldn't honor God as God, and because they wouldn't give him thanks, what did God do? He gave them over to their intellectual futility. So their minds were darkened because their hearts were rebellious. And the response to this is to love and honor God, which means that we should love and honor his kind of story. And I believe The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, along with all the Narnia books, are his kind of story. Okay? That's a story that we can be edified and built up greatly from because it mimics God's story. And the story of the creation and the fall, and the story of redemption, and the story of last things, glorification. So as we read Narnia, I hope we're ready to keep drawing those biblical comparisons and giving thanks to God for giving us great men like C.S. Lewis who can feed our imaginations, give us a good story, and strengthen our consciences and give us a taste for the true, the good, and the beautiful.